honest with you, like some of the chemicals, like I didn't recognize some of those chemicals, but all the chemicals that I recognize are fracking chemicals. You know, I kind of suspected that there would be some things. I can honestly tell you that I was a bit surprised how much. I mean, I knew, but I was like, wow. And then again, I knew it, but I had no idea to the level. And I guess that's because we're just completely, you know, it just completely encompasses us.
It definitely did show that we were above, you know, in some of the areas. So definitely that we've probably been amongst exposure. Just hard to say when and where, you know, because of the area that we live in, you know. Is it at the old house or was it through the school or, you know, was it in the house prior to that when we lived on State Route 50, you know? So it's hard to say when they were exposed.
We were shocked,
really.
Shocked.
Seeing the levels of the chemicals that are contained in our urine from exposure, and especially being his age at 9 when the study was taken, that he's the highest of everyone in the study. It's scary. I mean, it made me want to move to Antarctica or somewhere just to get the hell out of here.
Then they would go over to Antarctica and take all the oil out of the ice.
Yeah.
Welcome to Raging Chickens Out the Coop Live podcast for Wednesday, March 17th, 2021. Happy St. Patrick's Day. We're going to be going green in more ways than one today, folks. Yes, it's a special edition of Out the Coop, one of our midweek interviews. So on Out the Coop Live, we talk to progressives, activists, and troublemakers of all sorts, right from our own backyards and across the country. Today, we're more recorded live, but you get the deal. On Friday, Sean Kitchen and I, for our flagship show, break down the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. You can get both by subscribing to our podcast on Podbean, iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. You can help support this show by becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month by going to patreon.com/rcpress. That's patreon.com/rcpress. And you can also help out the show by heading on over to our YouTube channel, smash that subscribe button, hit the like for this stream of the show, and don't forget to ting that notification bell so you know every time we go live. And make sure to leave us that 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're looking for more PA progressive talk, tune into the Rick Smith Show's live stream at 9 p.m. Eastern on his YouTube channel, Twitter, Facebook, pretty much any place you can stream, you're going to find Rick there. And you can subscribe to his podcast and wherever you get your podcasts. And for those folks who've been tuning in to Out the Coop Live recently, you know I got to plug the game in. Yes, for all you gamers out there, I want to introduce you to the go-to place for all your gaming needs. Check out the Game Inn. That's Inn with two N's. Located on 309 in Quakertown, PA, the Game Inn is a Quakertown-based, black family-owned gaming store. Not only are they friends of the show and awesome folks all around, they have almost every gaming product that you can imagine, from retro N64s, Nintendo DSs, PS4s, and Switches. And personally, my favorite part about the store is their son is one of my son's best friends. So that's why I plug him on the show. Head on over them. You can check them out. They got great selection of collectibles, Funko Pops, all that. Kids get discounts with every A. Check them out on their Facebook page. Look up at the Twitter at the Game In with two N's. If you got questions about a game, looking for something hard to get, just message them on Facebook. Drop them an email at thegameinpa@gmail.com or check them out their website at thegameinwithtwoends.com. And a special shout out once again to Jonathan Mann, who wrote our intro song, There Are No People in the Future. Check out all his great stuff on his YouTube page and follow him on Twitter at songadayman. That's with two N's again, songadayman on Twitter. Well, on today's show, I am thrilled to be welcoming Christina Marusik to the show to talk about her devastating investigative series for Environmental Health News, Fractured, The Body Burden of Living Near Fracking. Fractured lays bare their scientific findings from a 9-week pilot study in southwestern PA, where families are exposed to harmful chemicals and the failure of local, state, and federal officials to protect communities' physical, mental, and social health. The series focuses on 5 families, 3 in Washington County, PA, and 2 in Westmoreland County, PA. And the study finds not only high levels of toxic chemicals in the air and water, but inside the bodies of these families, with children frequently showing the highest levels of toxins. The study also explores how the explosions of fracking in southwestern PA, and frankly, kind of other towns like it across the country, has also led to significant costs to the mental health of residents and the breakdown of social wellbeing. Christina Marusik covers environmental health and justice issues in Pittsburgh and Western PA. She has received recognition or awards from the Society of Environmental Journalists, the Association of Healthcare Journalists, the Society of Professional Journalists, and the National Institute of Healthcare Management, the Press Club of Western PA, the Carnegie Center, and the Pittsburgh-based Group Against Smog and Pollution, or GASP, for her reporting on these topics. And prior to joining EHN, Christina covered issues related to environmental and social justice as a freelancer for a wide range of digital media outlets, including Slate, Vice, Women's Health, MTV News, The Advocate, CNN, and Bustle. She is also the co-president and co-founder of the Pittsburgh chapter of the Association of LGBTQ Journalists. She is also working on a new book. Are you ready for this, folks? Yes, you gotta look for it immediately. Pre-order this as soon as you can. Right, it's called The New War on Cancer, about the doctors, researchers, and activists leading a nationwide movement to rethink cancer prevention strategies through the lens of toxic exposures. And that should be published by Island Press in 2022. She lives in Pittsburgh, where she spends much of her free time kayaking. This is also kind of like hits me because I'm dying to get out there right now again. Kayaking in the city's iconic 3 rivers, consuming coffee and eating adventurously. You can reach her at kmarusik@ehn.org and make sure to check out all the awesome reporting over at Environmental Health News at www.ehn.org. Welcome to the show, Christina.
Hi, thank you so much for having me, Kevin.
I'm thrilled to have you on. And I've told you this off air before, but I'm going to tell you this on air too, is that I was thrilled to have you on the show, in part because the series wrecked me reading it. It is such an incredible feat of like, one, the scientific depth in reporting at that level, but then also to have a story that resonates so well. I think that is a really difficult feat. And as I mentioned in the intro or before the show, that it's the same kind of issue when you're dealing with something like climate change, right? You can talk about all the scientific results possible, but sometimes that doesn't break through to people's minds. And here, in terms of the discussion with these families, it just was like so meaningful, so depth. I found myself in tears at times thinking about my own kids in here. So thank you right up front for this monumental work.
Thank you. It's really kind of you to say that. This was a story, I did some science, which is unusual for a journalist, for this reporting. And it's a really data heavy story. And so, like you said, I didn't want the people that are at the heart of this story to get kind of lost in all that data. And then I also spent a lot of time with these families doing this reporting. So I came to really care about them. And I really wanted to do right by them and get their stories out there, in addition to reporting the data from the science that we did.
Well, and I would say, you know, God, did you ever accomplish that? I mean, you know, the kids and the, you know, even the parents, they just really come to life in this piece. And I think I can't imagine like how happy they are to see themselves represented in the way that you represented them here. And I know the feat that that requires. So let me start with this, right? So for this report is making its circulation. I mean, I'm so happy to see it getting taken up in so many different circles, which is phenomenal. So let's start with kind of like brass tacks, so to speak. Like, what were you out to find in this study and why, right? And then what was the decision? Well, maybe we'll leave this for a kind of second round. What was the decision then to focus on these five families? So why start with this kind of chemical exposure?
Yeah, so I've been reporting on fracking in Western Pennsylvania for several years now, just as part of my reporting on environmental health in Western Pennsylvania. And I noticed that, you know, there are literally thousands of studies that have come out in the last 12 years that show that people who live close to fracking wells have a variety of health effects. But there's very little research out there about whether fracking chemicals are actually getting into people's bodies. And one of my colleagues had done something like this, looking for flame retardant chemicals in people's bodies in California in the Bay Area about 15 years ago. And so I think he just worked with one family, but it was this family that really cared about their health. They, you know, shopped organic, they exercised a lot, they had young children, they were very health conscious, but he found pretty alarming levels of these flame retardant chemicals that are linked to all kinds of nasty health effects in their bodies. And that reporting was really impactful. Lots of other similar reporting and work by NGOs later, the state ended up pretty heavily restricting the use of those types of chemicals in California, which then kind of changed what happened at the national level because people didn't, you know, manufacturers didn't want to make one set of products for California and another set of products for the rest of the states. So we wondered if we could do something similar related to fracking. So to start this project, I enlisted help from a whole bunch of different scientific advisors to ask them, you know, is this feasible? What might something like this look like? How would you go about doing something like this? And they helped me design a study protocol. I also got approval from an independent review board to ensure the study met ethical standards. Anytime you're doing research that involves people, it's technically right. Human subjects research. So you have to meet a lot of ethical standards doing something like that. And in the end, what we ended up doing, and I'm saying we, I work for Environmental Health News as a national publication, but we're very small. We're about 6 full-time people on staff, and we're spread out throughout the country. And I'm the only one in Western Pennsylvania. So I say we, but I did the majority of this work being out there collecting these samples. So I collected a total of 69 urine samples, 39 air samples, and 13 water samples from 5 families in Southwest Pennsylvania over a 9-week period in the summer of 2019. Those samples were analyzed for researchers at the University of Missouri who looked for 40 of the chemicals that are most commonly found in emissions from fracking sites. And we got that list from previous air monitoring studies that have been done throughout the country. So we looked to the existing scientific literature to come up with that list. And we had to do that in part because fracking companies in most states don't have to publicly disclose what chemicals they use in fracking fluid because it's considered proprietary.
Right.
So if that information was easily accessible, we might have gotten a list for, you know, what was happening here in PA. But instead we look to, you know, what are the chemicals that most often show up in emissions from these well pads. Did I cover what else did you
Yeah, ask well, me? Let me ask you this. So when you set out to do this, how much of this was like, we don't know if this is going to be the case, and so let's see? And how much of this were kind of like, no, there's probably a good chance that these chemicals are showing up in people. We don't know that for sure yet. There's not the studies out there, but we kind of suspect that this is where things are going to be.
Yeah, that's a good question. So I could only find two other studies out there that had done biomonitoring related to fracking. One was in Wyoming, and it was a study of farm workers who were working outdoors in fields near these fracking wells all day. And then they also lived near the fracking wells. So the thinking was that they would likely have higher levels of exposures than fracking workers, for example, because they don't go home and leave the site at the end of the day. They're kind of always there. And that study did find relatively high levels of exposures in those folks. And I talked to the people who did that study when designing my study. And actually, the laboratory analysis for our study was done by the same people who did the laboratory analysis for the Wyoming study. The researcher is named Chung Ho Lin, and he kind of developed this cutting-edge analytical methodology to screen the urine samples. And then the other study was in Canada, and it was a study of pregnant mothers who live near fracking, and that study also found some higher than average levels of exposure. So that's too little. They were both kind of small, pilot study type things, so there wasn't much to go on, and there wasn't much to look to for an example of how to do something like this. So we definitely had discussions of, you know, we could do all this and find nothing. And as a small organization, we spent about $60,000 on the study, which is a good chunk of a nonprofit news organization's budget. And we had to decide up front, you know, well, if we test and we find nothing, then that'll be good news for these families, and we'll report it anyway. We'll have to, you know, we'll report right. whatever we find. So we went in knowing that, you know, we weren't kind of guaranteed to find something with this investigation. And we also, part of the reason that we collected multiple urine samples spread out over the course of a summer and multiple air samples. So we know that emissions from fracking wells and compressor stations and pipelines and other related infrastructure tend to be very sporadic. It's unlikely. It's not like, you know, sometimes something like a coal-fired power plant might have pretty consistent measurable right. levels of emissions. But then fracking wells, they're very sporadic. So you might see nothing for weeks and weeks, and then there might be this huge plume that's full of lots of toxic chemicals that last for just 15 minutes, but anyone in the vicinity is being exposed during that time, which can also, you know, has different kinds of risks and long-term potential for harm than those kind of constant emissions that are carefully monitored and tracked. So we did three urine samples for each person in the study and two air monitoring samples. And we tried to spread them out over time, thinking, you know, hoping that we wouldn't just catch someone on a weird day or something. So we had a better sense and a better ability to say, you know, are there huge differences in their level of exposure throughout the summer? You know, and just so to kind of try to account for that. In an ideal world, with endless resources, you would want to do something like this every day
right, sure.
over a long period of time. But with the resources we had, you know, we wanted to have the best chance of kind of capturing what their normal exposures might look like.
Well, and what's remarkable about this, and we'll get to this a little bit later in the discussion, but I mean, this is essentially, you talk about that daily monitoring. This is essentially what should be being done by federal and state and local regulators. I mean, this is the fact that you have a nonprofit organization, a small nonprofit organization with limited funds doing this kind of bang up work, right? With $60,000, right? Is it that shows you what's possible. If we want to know, we can know. So we'll definitely get into that quite a bit. So let me one more thing on the kind of the sciencey end of things, right? Before we talk about the families, which I really want to get to, the other thing that I found pretty very interesting in the discussion, and again, someone who's not a scientist kind of coming at this, I wouldn't have been considering these things looking ahead of time, but the kind of controls that you had to have in this study to kind of being able to identify these different kind of markers of these chemicals that break down, right? So it's not like you say, okay, you've got benzene, right? And so there's that benzene molecule and it's going to stay there for the rest of your life, right? You have to find ways in the study to be able to identify what's a likely cause. And I also should say for everybody who's doing this, you're also extraordinarily careful, right? To not overclaim things in this study, right? You're saying, okay, look, here's the range of things that could be contributing to this. However, this is why we think that there's an association or correlation with what was going on with your fracking. So can you talk a little bit about having to deal with that, like even to be able to identify those impacts?
Yeah, so I mentioned that flame retardant study that one of my colleagues had done. And this was very different from that because a lot of these chemicals we looked for show up in a lot of places other than just fracking emissions. So when we're talking about things like benzene and toluene and naphthalene, you know, it's well established that those have some pretty severe health effects and it's not good to be breathing them in. But we also know that you can find those in things like vehicle exhaust and cigarette smoke and some like paints and varnishes and household cleaners. It's a pretty long list. So we expect that everybody has some level of these compounds in their bodies to begin with. Another thing that made this tricky and part of the reason we wanted to do multiple samples spread out over time is that the chemicals we look for mostly are processed through the body very quickly. So you said, you know, it's not like you get benzene in your body once and then it's in there forever. Right. The body processes those and gets rid of them usually within a couple of days for most of the chemicals we looked for. So the exposures we found really reflect what was happening in like a 1 to 3 day period leading up to when we collected our samples, which is part of why we did air monitoring in tandem at the same time as we collected the urine samples. So because we expect everybody to have some level of these chemicals in their bodies, we also looked for, I should also mention that some chemical exposures aren't detectable in urine if your body has already processed them. So if you were exposed to a given chemical, but your body has already dealt with it, you might not have benzene in your urine, but you might have something that's called a biomarker for benzene. And so that's the product that's left over after your body has broken down that initial chemical that you were exposed to. And so to figure out if what we were seeing was kind of in a normal range based on the level of exposure to these chemicals we all get just by virtue of living in the world and being exposed to various household products and driving cars, we compared the levels of these biomarkers that we found against national averages. So the CDC has published data on the levels of some of these biomarkers in the average American through something called the National Health and Nutrition Survey. Science-y folks sometimes refer to it as NHANES for short. And comparing our numbers against those, we found that the families we tested who live near fracking operations had significantly higher than average levels of many of these compounds. So for example, all 20 people in the study exceeded not only the average, but also the 95th percentile, which is the level that 95% of Americans fall below for mandelic acid, which is a biomarker for ethylbenzene and styrene. And exposure to ethylbenzene and styrene is linked to skin, lung, and eye irritation, central nervous system, liver, and kidney damage, and cancer. And in another example, we looked for a biomarker called heparic acid, and that is in your body after your body breaks down toluene. Toluene exposure is linked to skin, eye, and respiratory irritation, infertility and reproductive harm, and damage to the nervous system, liver, and kidneys. And we had 1 9-year-old boy in the study who had a level of heparic acid in his urine that was more than 91 times as high as the U.S. median and about almost 5 times as high as the 95th percentile. So we were surprised that these exposures were so high. And this is a good time to reiterate that this was a very, you know, 20 people is not enough to say that we can prove definitively that these exposures came from fracking. But we do think that it certainly means that there's value in doing this kind of biomonitoring work related to fracking. Right. And I hope that someone will, with additional resources, will undertake this research on a much larger scale. It's also worth noting that I did try to account for other sources of exposure to these chemicals. So I had each of the families fill out a really extensive survey about, you know, their use of paints and varnishes in the home and cleaning products. I kept really close records of what everybody did in like the 24 hours leading up to the urine sample collection. And if there was stuff that they did that I thought, you know, could have contributed to these mm-hmm. higher levels of exposures, I mentioned it in my reporting. So there are some places in the reporting where I say, you know, she had this really high level of exposure. She drove her car that day, which could have contributed. Or, you know, there was one boy in the study who had some really high exposures, but he had like helped his dad remove some vinyl flooring. And we know that vinyl flooring can have some pretty nasty stuff. So I mentioned that that could be a contributing factor. But again, you know, most Americans drive in their car and most Americans have like household cleaners right. and stuff around. So we still thought it was really striking and that some of these folks had so much higher than average levels of exposure to these compounds. And it seems pretty obvious that, you know, a likely contributing source is that they live really close to all of these fracking wells that we know are emitting these chemicals.
Absolutely. And this is what, you know, one of the reasons that I kind of wanted to really mention that, you know, that you went at pains to not overclaim things. I mean, you know, there were times in here, you know, I'm looking like, come on, that is clearly, you know, but it's, but you know, you say, okay, but wait a minute, let's be conservative in what we're going to make our claims here. And the very fact, you know, you start with, you know, the Bauer-Bjornsson family, right? And that's one of the examples where they have, there's a lot of other things were going on, like the use of cleaners and things that could have contributed. And that's the lead case, right? So right at the top, you're starting with it, you know, starting with the story of this, this family with exposures that, you know, you're laying it bare right at the get-go. Okay, look, here's all the things that we're doing. And the other point that you mentioned there is really important for, I think, for everybody to understand is that you didn't just kind of, you know, like drop in, you know, collect a urine sample and drop out. I mean, you spent time with these families and then, you know, you've got records of, okay, what were they doing throughout their days in the like ahead of that urine sample, right? So that, you know, as best possible, right? I mean, you're going out of your way to kind of to say, here's all the contributors. That's really, I think, kind of important for this kind of study too. And it's like you said, it's like, okay, if this is a limited study from, you know, nonprofit organization with the part of the goal of to say, okay, here you go, world. You know, we've charted a process, we've charted a pathway for you to do this work, right? And we're going to give you the solid baseline to go from, right? For your own research. Here you go. And you know, again, I'm just like, I'm astounded for all this. Well, let's go into the, we got some of that science. Obviously we're not going to get away from the science throughout this today, but the other part of this, right, was that this is not just the science, right? That we also get the story of the families kind of who are involved. And I guess, well, let me just say this before I kind of ask you a little about how you found these families and stuff. But one of the things that struck me kind of going in is that all of these, the people in this study had some notion, right, that they were being affected somehow, right? Some of them, obviously, when you get to the families in the end who are actually kind of working against the pipelines, they were, you know, on it, right? They were kind of like, you know, steeped in some of the stuff, and even they were surprised. I'm getting ahead of myself here. But the other families just like noticing health effects with the kids, noticing, you know, that they don't feel so well, noticing respiratory issues, noticing bloody noses kept on recurring. So talk us through a little bit about like these five families. How did you kind of find them, right, number one? And what made you want to kind of really lead with their stories, right out in front?
Yeah, so to find the families, I partnered with the Southwest Pennsylvania Environmental Health Project, which is a nonprofit health advocacy group based in Washington County that primarily serves residents who live near fracking and tries to help them minimize their exposures. You know, they're kind of unique in this nonprofit sphere because they're not... they're not like an anti-fracking group. Their mission is to, you know, the founder saw that there was effectively no local health department and that people weren't getting the help they needed from the state health department, and was a toxicologist and just thought like these people clearly need resources. So they're really there to field, you know, they have a nurse practitioner on staff, and they field calls from people in the community who are concerned, and they put out information on, like, when the wind is blowing this direction, shut your windows kind of stuff to try and help people minimize their exposures.
Well, can I just say about that too? One of the small details in this report that blew my mind, I just did not know this, was that there's only, what, I think 5 or 6 counties that have their own health department.
Yeah, in Pennsylvania, that's true. There are a handful of like small, I forget what they're called, but they're like health centers, and they do like STD screening, and you can get like a TB test there. You can get some vaccinations, but they don't have the capacity to answer calls about something like this. They're not like, you know, they're not like a full urgent care clinic.
Right,
they offer
sure.
the 4 services they offer. And so this area is really kind of underserved in terms of public health. So this organization stepped in to help fill that gap. And I was familiar with them from my previous reporting work. So I asked if they would help me recruit families for the study. And so I mentioned that I had to go through that independent review board to meet ethical standards. And one of the things they looked at was our flyer for the study, to make sure that we weren't overpromising, to make sure people knew what they were getting into, to make sure people knew what sort of risks in being involved in something like this would entail. And then the Environmental Health Project essentially sent that out to their email list and asked if people were interested. And then we had a pretty stringent set of criteria for how close or far people had to live to fracking wells and other infrastructure. I wanted each family in the study to have at least one child. So every family in the study had a kid, which is also one of the reasons I wanted to do that, is that I mentioned there are only 2 other studies like this that I know of. Neither of them included children. And so I really wanted to be able to include children in the testing we did. So they sent out the flyer, and we got lots of emails from interested people. One of the other reasons, you know, I've kind of emphasized that this is a small study, is that so it wasn't random, right? We didn't pick a random group of people. These were people who are already concerned about the health effects and on this list and aware enough to be willing to spend 2 years doing something like this. So, you know, a much bigger, more robust study would do kind of a random sampling in the community. Yeah, the Environmental Health Project was incredibly helpful connecting us with the families who got involved. And we did want to look at, you mentioned that 3 of the families are in Washington County, which is really heavily fracked. It's where a majority of the fracking in the state of Pennsylvania happens.
Well, and I should say too, we had Sean O'Leary on the show a couple weeks back about their report about the economic impacts. And what I thought was so interesting about seeing these two reports overlap was that Washington County is, of all these counties, West Virginia, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, was probably the most prosperous, right? Mm-hmm. Of all of them. So you're not, I mean, that's important to kind of point out, simply to say that this was not the worst of the worst, right? This is not the county that was kind of economically completely devastated. If anything, this would be the county that even, like, you know, the fossil fuel industry would hold up as kind of like a success story. And you even see this with some of the politicians that you talk to and so on. Mm-hmm. So we should say that too, as well, is because, you know, this is Washington County, not like the worst story of fracking. And still,
yeah, that's true. It's pretty middle class. Most of the, you know, the 5 families we looked at were well, sort of middle class. That's I don't want to say that was true for all of them, but for the most part, the county is doing pretty well economically. Yeah, that's correct. And so I wanted to include 2 families who live in Westmoreland County, which is a less rural and more suburban county outside of Pittsburgh. And those 2 families lived at least 7 miles away from the nearest well, whereas the 3 families in Washington County had a well within 5 miles of their home. So, and the thinking there was just to see, you know, they weren't a true control since they still had fracking wells relatively close to their house, but just to see, you know, do we see wildly differing levels of exposure in people who live a little bit further away versus, you know, closer to a large volume of wells. And then you asked about spending time with these families.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I knew from the beginning that, I wanted their stories to be kind of front and center. You know, as soon as I started talking to them and heard some of the hardships they've endured related to this, and also just got to know them and came to like their kids and enjoy spending time with them. You know, I wanted to make sure, and I mentioned this in the beginning, but I knew this was going to be a really like data heavy story, and I didn't want the people that are at the heart of this issue to get kind of lost in that mix.
Well, and I think that too is like, you know, we should also tell people that, you know, and accompanying this report, and you hear some of their sound, both at the cold open for the show and then some of the breaks we're going to do, but definitely to head over to, you know, the story itself. The link will be, you know, obviously all the links to, it's going to take you where you need to go are going to be in the show notes for the day. But there's all these videos of the families, right? So some of the interviews and some discussions, you get to hear their own words and their expressions. And, you know, like I said, just be prepared just because it's heart-wrenching. And what's, in a weird way, what made it even more difficult is that none of these families that you talk to were like, you know, claiming victimhood sort of thing. These are, you know, all of them seemed like tough Scrabble folks, right? I mean, and they didn't want this, you know, and the determination to kind of push through on top of it all, which is, you know, because that could be one of the pitfalls of this kind of story, is that the only time you get to see actual real people is that when, say, the author of the story or the documentary, whatever it is, wants to show a kind of like a sad picture of these, and there's plenty of that, let me be clear. Mm-hmm. But it was also about, you know, these are whole people who are struggling to live their lives in the best the way they can. And the choices that they're making for their families, they're trying to do the absolute best. They're doing everything they should be doing, right? To keep their family safe, to keep their families healthy. And still, we mm-hmm. find them with this. So maybe if you could take us in, I mean, like, if we had all day, I would love to go through every single one of these people, because they seem all remarkable in their own right. But are there some kind of, say, certain families or stories throughout this thing that seem to kind of stand up, that would kind of give us a sense of what these impacts were like and what these families were like?
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Bauer Bjornsons, and mm-hmm. I do think their story kind of stands out. So they initially moved to Washington County, Lois and her husband Dave, because they wanted to have more kids. They wanted to grow their family. And they live in a little town called Scenery Hill, which is an apt name because it's just this beautiful. I actually felt really fortunate when my job in the summer of 2019, pre-pandemic, involved getting to go out there and drive around on summer days in this just absolutely gorgeous area, because it's these rolling green hills and there's little patches of forest and there are family farms and they have a cute little main street that's got like a pie shop and a yoga studio. Yeah. It's just a really kind of naturally beautiful part of the state. And so they moved there before the fracking boom, and they now have four kids. And then within a couple years of them moving there, you know, the fracking industry also moved into the neighborhood. So they weren't too concerned about it initially. They thought, you know, maybe this will be good for the local economy.
Sure.
They actually leased, they didn't have mineral rights to lease, but they leased part of their property to a fracking company to run a transmission line through. They got, I think, something like $12,000 for that, which is helpful for a young family.
Sure.
So they didn't have any big opposition to the industry when it first showed up. But pretty quickly, this like idyllic country life that they had envisioned for their kids started to transform. So all of a sudden, the small two-lane road that's right in front of their house went from having, you know, kind of a slow trickle of cars throughout the day to a ton of heavy truck traffic. They could hear drilling that was happening at wells that were cropping up kind of all around their property. They could smell it. There were strange smells in the air. At night, the drilling rigs would put up these huge, bright spotlights. So there was all this unnatural light around. Mm-hmm. They could see and smell flaring. So there'd be these huge flames licking into the air. And they felt like all of a sudden they lived in this like heavy industrial zone, which was not what they had signed up for. So it was a pretty dramatic change to their quality of life. And then, and in addition, when the wells were first being drilled, there's this influx of workers who are often from out of the area. And Lois described, I'm not sure if this even made it into the reporting, but Lois described to me that they would have people there to direct well traffic to trucks, and they would just like sleep in tents alongside the road. Yep. So there would be all these strangers who were in spitting distance from their house, just sleeping in tents, which was a little unsettling for a family with young kids. They didn't know these folks. And
A whole bunch of out of state, primarily men sleeping in tents outside their house. That would be a little unnerving to me too, as well with my kids. Yeah.
Yeah. And then they started experiencing some health symptoms. So one of the kids, Gunner, in particular, had a lot of nosebleeds. They started getting some headaches and rashes. But Gunner would have these nosebleeds that would just last for like an hour and drain all the color from his face. And it was very unsettling for them. And he was pretty little at the time. He was 13 in the summer of 2019 when we did our testing, but this had been earlier around when the wells were first being drilled. And he told me that he got a nosebleed at school once and asked his teacher not to tell his mom because he knew that she got worried. And
that was one of the parts that wrecked me. it was like this kid, so present of what the impact it's having on his parents and wants to protect his parents because he recognized how that's taking a toll. And that was...
Yeah.
That was something.
So, we tested their air and their water, and we took urine samples that we do with all the families. I mentioned some of those kind of overall numbers we found that were pretty surprising, but, in Gunner, the boy who had the nosebleeds, we found a level of mandelic acid, which is a biomarker for ethylbenzene and styrene, that was 55 times as high as is seen in the average American, and it was higher than levels that are typically seen in the average adult cigarette smoker. Ethylbenzene and styrene are linked to skin, eye, and respiratory tract irritation, reproductive harm, endocrine disruption, or hormone disruption, and increased cancer risk. More than half of the family samples exceeded the 95th percentile for phenylglyoxylic acid, which is another biomarker for ethylbenzene and styrene, and more than 40% of the family samples exceeded the 95th percentile, the U.S. 95th percentile for hippuric acid and transmuconic acid, and those are biomarkers for toluene and benzene. And they're linked to similar health effects, things like skin, lung, and eye irritation, central nervous system, liver and kidney damage, and increased cancer risk. So, Lois said at the time that she expected to see some level of exposure based on the health symptoms they've been having. Mm-hmm. But she was pretty shocked by some of these numbers. And their house is in a place where, one of the things she mentioned is that they're just completely surrounded by fracking wells at this point and compressor stations. And she said, even when the kids go to school, it's not like they get away from this. So it's just 24 hours a day that they're kind of in this mix of all of these fracking wells. So I think for them, a lot of their primary concerns were about the changes to their quality of life. And then after testing, Lois was shocked, and certainly a little upset by the results. And that's particularly true. I had to deliver these results in the middle of a pandemic. Right. And so that felt extra hard because a lot of these chemicals have respiratory effects. And we know that exposure to air pollution can make people more vulnerable to, the effects of COVID-19. So to kind of try to account for that, it also made it hard because I couldn't go tell them in person. I had to do this over Zoom instead of going out. Which was just hard. But I did, I made sure to, before I gave them the results, I went over the results with a physician who offered to consult with the families about their findings. And I offered to put them in touch with you know, to connect them with mental health resources to make sure that they weren't kind of left with this
right.
upsetting news and nowhere to turn. And the Environmental Health Project was also a partner in this. You know, they offered to they were happy to hear from the families if they had questions about minimizing their exposures and what to do next and how to talk to their doctor and that kind of thing.
Well, let me ask you too, because you mentioned this stuff about the impact on mental health. And I think that this was a feature or two of this reporting that, again, it would be, you could understand if somebody were focusing purely on what was happening with the bodies and the chemicals. But you talk about Lexi, right, at one point. And that not only does she have some, you know, the physical symptoms, right, but this leads over into a kind of like a direct impact on her mental health to the point where they actually have to move, right? Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit about that story? And I mean, because this is also this is where you're also, I think, getting into the points of, you know, these fracking wells are next to schools, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, a little bit about Lexi and that kind of like looking at that mental health impact that you're finding. I mean, again, I don't want to limit it to just her, because this was something, a theme across all of these families that you found.
Yeah. So Lexi was 15 when I met her, and she lived with her stepbrother and her grandmother. And her grandmother had raised both kids from the time they were babies on her own. And when a fracking well was drilled about a half a mile from Lexi's middle school and elementary school, she started getting really sick with a bunch of strange kind of mysterious symptoms. So she had like muscle cramping and fatigue. She had rashes. She would have like bouts of kind of uncontrollable vomiting, headaches. She just had a lot of symptoms that her doctors couldn't figure out for a long time. So they tried everything, you know, they took out the carpets and to eliminate dust. They thought maybe it was an allergy and got rid of the stuffed animals and changed the detergent and tried dietary changes, all the things you would do if your child was sick and you thought it might be, you know, the doctors thought this might be an environmental exposure, but they weren't sure to what. And then eventually they thought, you know, maybe this is related to the fracking well. Lexi, a long time passed, and Lexi was eventually able to see a toxicologist who determined that she had been exposed to benzene and said it was likely that she had a really high level of sensitivity to benzene, a higher than usual level of sensitivity to benzene exposure. And so, you know, at that point, they were afraid that the fracking well was to blame. She had been, you know, there are various phases in drilling that are associated with like higher levels of emissions. And when they looked back, they saw that like a lot of times when she was the most sick was when something was going on at the well that would cause higher levels of emission. And we know that benzene is often emitted from fracking wells. So her grandmother started, you know, like going to town hall meetings and school board meetings to try and raise these concerns. And it caused the family to become really alienated from their community. So a lot of the people there had leased their mineral rights. She felt that a lot of the people on the school board, you know, had this like vested interest in this industry, you know, because and she was pretty generous about that. It's not like anyone was getting super rich. She was like, people need that money. People right. need the money to live. So but she felt that because of that, they were less likely to listen to them and hear their concerns. And there were a handful of other families who were worried, who'd had kids who'd been sick. But they had instances where they got like shouted at to leave town at a town hall meeting. And the kids were pretty little at this point, and they're being screamed at by grown adults to get out of town and shut up about this. And then Lexi also felt there, she had several instances where she became really sick at school, where she was like vomiting in front of all of her classmates. And so she felt like she kind of became known as like sick girl, which felt stigmatizing for her. And then she had both teachers and fellow students and students' parents kind of frequently grilling her, saying things like, are you just making this up for attention? You know, if this is happening because of the fracking well, why wouldn't everybody be sick? Like, you know, trying to suss out Are you, you know, are there other things she might be doing that could be causing this? Which was really stressful for her, as you can imagine. And then especially this was all kind of happening when she was in middle school, which is already a difficult time for kids.
Right.
And then she was just feeling, you know, super alienated from her classmates. She felt like adults were accusing her of being a liar. So this was all pretty stressful for her. She started dealing with pretty severe anxiety and depression. Oh, at one point, they got a portable air monitor for her to try and protect her from benzene exposure, but it would make a really loud noise to alert if there was like an unsafe level of benzene in the air. And then it would like go off in class, and then everyone would be staring at her, and then her teacher would be mad because it was disruptive and asking her to leave. She had to miss a bunch of school. It was just this series of events that led to her feeling really uncomfortable at school. And she had such dread for going there, both because she thought it was going to make her sick and because she felt so alienated from her classmates and teachers, that the family ended up moving to get to a different school district. And we did our testing after that move. But they stayed kind of in the region because that's where their roots are. And that's where, you know, the grandmother's, Jane is Lexi's grandma. That's where her job is. So they moved to like an adjacent school district, and they were eligible for the study because we found out they were still within 5 miles of producing well. Mm-hmm. And there weren't any well pads that close to the school, but they actually ended up transferring to Cannon McMillan School District, which is where you might have seen the Post-Gazette reporting out last year.
Yep.
There's been a kind of rash of rare childhood cancers that people fear might be related to fracking. And our testing found that they are still being exposed to harmful chemicals. So in the testing we did for them, we found a mixture of harmful chemicals in the air and water. None were above regulatory thresholds. But when I talk about these air and water results, I try to mention that, you know, we looked for 40 chemicals, and a very small handful, 4 or 5, are regulated in any way at the federal or state level, either in air or in drinking water. And so of those small group of chemicals, we didn't find any that exceeded regulatory thresholds. To interpret the results, the data results here, I talked to a lot of scientists, since I'm not a scientist, try and contextualize it, figure out what I was looking at. And one of the things that numerous researchers told me is that, first of all, a lot of these regulations haven't been updated in 20 years. And so they were based on available technology for water specifically. They were based on how affordable and how accessible it was for small municipal water systems to be able to take benzene out of water. And that, as you can imagine how much other technology has changed in 20 years, is radically different now, but we still haven't updated a lot of those federal standards. So the emphasis there was that, like, if the legal limit for benzene is 5 parts per million in your water, and you have 4 parts per million in your water,
just everything's fine.
Yeah, right. It's still not safe. It's still not safe for humans to be drinking that. So, and then they also pointed out that chemical mixtures can be harmful in ways that are potentially more than additives. So they add up, but they can also like interact and worsen the effects of one another. And then, you know, one researcher pointed out about the air samples, if you're finding detectable levels of 10 different carcinogens and they're all below legal thresholds, those legal thresholds don't necessarily take into account that you're getting exposed to all 10 of them simultaneously in your air. So we found a mixture of harmful chemicals in the air and the water, though none were above regulatory thresholds. And we found 18 chemicals known to be commonly emitted from fracking sites in one or more of their urine samples. And that list included benzene, toluene, naphthalene, and a bunch of lesser known compounds. All of the family's urine samples exceeded the US 95th percentile for mandelic acid, which is that biomarker for ethylbenzene and styrene. More than half of their samples exceeded the 95th percentile for phenylglyoxylic acid, which is another biomarker for ethylbenzene and styrene, and for transmuconic acid, which is a biomarker for benzene. And Yeah, there's more. Their urine sample suggested they had higher than average exposure to biomarkers for toluene and xylenes. All of these chemicals have those health effects I've mentioned again and again, which is skin, eye, and respiratory problems, gastrointestinal irritation, neurological issues, increased cancer risk. And we did find detectable levels of benzene in their drinking water and in the urine samples. And so, you know, knowing that Lexi has this sensitivity to benzene, they kind of came away saying, like, we assumed that municipal water would be safe, but I guess we should start filtering our water too after this. And I think that was frustrating for them because they had moved to try and escape this problem and then found out, like, oh, we're still being exposed. Yeah. And, you know, they kind of came away feeling like, if you want to stay in Pennsylvania, like, where can you go? Where could we have gone to feel safe?
Right, exactly. You're asking people, you know, again, you're talking about, like, say, industrial. The way I read it, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but the way I read it is, I'm looking at this as kind of like, this is like industrial economic systemic abuse, because it's like, where do you go? And you're told that, well, I mean, like, literally you're hearing, and again, they're not saying it as directly. I don't think they're fully aware of what they're saying, but they're saying, like, what's the problem? If you don't like it, leave. Why can't you just leave this, like, abusive relationship with fracking in Western Pennsylvania? I mean, that's like, that's what kept on coming back again and again and again. And that you've got, even in that, in the situation at the schools with Lexi, right? I mean, look, I don't have a very kind of fanciful kind of, like, you know, unicorn idea about the way that people act in the world, right? I mean, I know kids can be cruel, right? I know people can be cruel. I know when people are put up against the wall, when they're challenged with something, that they'll fight back and be defensive, even if that's not based on things. I think that's how people are. It's why this stuff is so difficult. So, you know, but you're seeing, like, the actor that's kind of behind the scenes, right? You got this huge industry, mm-hmm. right? Is the one who's, like, the abuser in the scenario, right? I mean, and all these folks in one role or another are either having to kind of force to play a role of, you know, what, we're going to kind of defend the abuser, or we are going to carry out this. We're going to, you know, we're going to be the minions on the ground, or I'm going to be like someone like Lexi, who's going to be a situation of feeling like having to doubt herself. Is there something wrong with me? Especially, as you said, she's in middle school. Mm-hmm. I mean, your identity is in the middle of forming at that point, right? And mm-hmm. and your body's full with hormones. You're kind of trying to make sense of the world, and boom, this is the thing. And so I kept on hearing that all throughout this, you know, all throughout this reporting. And it's I want to get to the, you know, the regulator stuff and some of the industry stuff kind of like in a bit. But before we go to a break, I do want to talk about the two families from Westmoreland, right? Because they were outside the immediate impact of fracking. Like you said, they were kind of, was a 7 mile radius, mm-hmm. I think. So they're outside this, right? And they're like, okay, we're in a kind of a safer little place. We're in a kind of like more suburban particular town. These were families that were involved with trying to stop pipelines, right? They were very aware. You're describing that, you know, they ate well, chose organic, right? Made sure they bought local. They're doing mm-hmm. everything that we're supposed to do as individuals, mm-hmm. right? To try to make our lives healthy. And yet they find that, well, no, you're not safe, right? So yeah. Tell me a little about those families.
Yeah. So their stories were really interesting. The moms of both of those families at the time worked together at a nonprofit that was dedicated to keeping fracking out of their little township, Trafford, in Westmoreland County. And they had been successful so far. So there had been plans to drill, and their nonprofit, which is called Protect PT, which stands for Penn and Trafford Townships. There were wells that were supposed to go in, but they had, like, tied them up in court for years, so they hadn't actually been drilled yet. But again, because this is so ubiquitous in Western Pennsylvania at this point, they still had a well, you know, the nearest well was about 7 miles from both of their houses. And so testing them, again, we were surprised. We thought that they might have kind of lower levels of exposures, but all of the samples from both of those families exceeded the U.S. 95th percentile for mandelic acid, which is that biomarker for ethylbenzene and styrene again. Almost 90% of The two moms are named Anne and Jillian. Almost 90% of Anne's family samples exceeded the U.S. 95th percentile for phenylglyoxylic acid, another biomarker for ethylbenzene and styrene. And Jillian's little girl, Lily, who was 9 years old at the time we did our samples, had the highest level of something called 3-methylhippuric acid, which is the biomarker for xylene that we detected in anyone in our study. And xylene exposure is linked to skin, eye, and respiratory tract irritation, drowsiness, and dizziness. And with long-term exposure, high levels of long-term exposure can do some damage to internal organs. So I looked pretty extensively in the story about these two women into some of the other potential sources of exposure for them. And I talked to lots of like air quality experts about, you know, things that might be impacting them. And in that process, I found out that they are surrounded by dozens of functioning operational conventional oil and gas wells, which I was surprised by because it's sort of this suburban county. So I just didn't realize that they were going to, I mean, when you look at the map, it's like a alarming number within 5 miles of their house. It's like legitimately, I think my fact checker said she counted 100.
Jesus.
Yeah. So a lot of conventional oil and gas wells, and they have, they've been a lot less studied than fracking wells. They do have kind of similar emissions. We know less about them and whether they're sporadic, and they have a shorter list of chemical concerns from them, but there is some overlap in what comes out of those. And then they're also closer to some of the big industrial sources of pollution in Pittsburgh. And the air quality experts I talked to said, you know, they could be getting some of the air pollution that blows over from the Clairton Coke Works facility here, which is like the largest remaining coke facility in the country. They heat coal at really extremely high temperatures to convert it into coke for steel making, and it has some of the nastiest emissions in the country. So they're getting some of that exposure. They kind of live closer, you know, because it's less rural, to more busy roadways, and they have their own like small industrial sources of emission in the county. And I compared some of those against what we see in Washington County. But I think the big takeaway for me from their story was that oil and gas infrastructure is so ubiquitous in Western Pennsylvania. So it's not just fracking wells, right? There are conventional wells, right? And we are in the process of developing a vast network of pipelines that gets more vast by the day. And there's compressor stations, and there's all these other pieces of infrastructure. And then that's being added to by the petrochemical plant that's being built here in Beaver County, the Shell ethane cracker, which is going to convert ethane from all these fracking wells into plastic nurdles for use in plastics manufacturing. And that has its own whole set of infrastructure and a lot of these similar chemical emissions of concern. It's not open yet. It's close to completion. But, you know, I think the big takeaway for me is that, like, it's just so hard to get away from these types of exposures in Western Pennsylvania, because even these women who had fought so hard and been successful in keeping fracking out of their little township in an attempt to protect their kids from this, you know, one step outside their little township and it's just everywhere. And then you also mentioned, you know, that I think a lot of times the response to this is like, well, why don't they just move? And, you know, for these families, like a lot of times, for a lot of them, they grew up in this region. This is where their entire social network is. Their friends are here. Their extended families are here. The grandparents who help out with the kids are here. The kids' schools are here. You know, they're like, why should we have to uproot our whole entire lives and go somewhere else just to have healthy air to breathe? And I think, you know, those families, as you mentioned, they're because they were engaged in this kind of work, they're pretty aware of like trying to avoid toxic exposure. So they're careful about the cleaning products they use, and they're careful about shopping organic and all the stuff they eat. And so it was disheartening for them to see these test results and say, like, you know, we're trying so hard to keep our kids safe, and we're still being exposed to these harmful chemicals.
Well, and I look at, you know, this is like runs right up against the, you know, the way that I think, you know, getting away from fossil fuels and things that has been dealt with up until now, is that, you know, there's all these individual choices, and, you know, people can feel really good about themselves making kind of really individual choices. And that's not to knock them. Obviously, that's, I mean, those are, mm-hmm. you know, good choices to make and all that stuff. But to run right up against the limits of those choices in such a stark way. That's what, I mean, when you hit that part of the story, when they're like, you know, the results, like, we've done everything right. And, you know, imagine ourselves as healthy. Mm-hmm. And here we are, we're still stuck. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely kind of remarkable. Well, I don't want to get too far away from this, but I do want to kind of go up into a break. I want to come back and talk a little about some of the regulatory stuff that's going on here. You know, it's just, it's something. I don't know if you're listening to this at this point, right? You're kind of like hanging on to the next thing, you know, you think this is where it kind of ends. It does not, right? It's kind of goes on and on, but we're going to come back. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to go look at some of the kind of state, kind of local, state, and federal kind of regulatory kind of issues and some of the failures of kind of the way that, you know, our kind of governments are dealing with this. So this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. We're going to be back right after this quick break. We're going to remind you, you can help support this show by going to Patreon.com/RC Press, and you can become a patron for as little as $5 a month. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. We'll be back right after this.
Normally, we'd be having public meetings. We'd be, you know, going to the DEP to get files. We cannot go to the DEP to get files. And it's been like pulling teeth to get them to, you know, talk to us, to, you know, acknowledge our file request. And, you know, I'm sure that they're, you know, inundated. They've been understaffed for years, but at some point you just have to feel like, what do we have to do to get the documents that we have requested back in March, in February. But they're permitting at an alarming rate, yet the public has no access to that information. And that to me is unacceptable.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out to Coop Live. Yes, it's a live, recorded live show that's part of our kind of midweek series that we've been slowly cultivating interview. Of course, I'm here with, you know what? I meant to mention, ask you at the top of the show, am I even pronouncing your last name right?
Yes, you nailed it.
Marusik, right? Is that right? Yep. Okay. Yep. I was like, I meant to ask you before we went on. I'm like, oh, I got to make sure I got the accent right. Like, is it the right syllable? Okay, sorry. That's totally off the board. Sorry, everybody.
All good.
I want to make sure I meant to mention.
You got it. Right. I was impressed. I was okay, like, great, you did it. Awesome. Didn't even have to ask. Yep.
Fantastic. Okay, great. So, you know, it got me thinking. I was, you know, I want to talk a little bit about some of the impacts. You mentioned a lot of the story. You talk about, you know, the failure of regulation and stuff. And, I was brought back when you were talking about these families seeing the change when the fracking industry came in, about the truck traffic and everything like this. It brought me back to a time, I want to say it was 2012, but my grandmother passed away. I'm originally from upstate New York, from Utica, New York. We call it Central New York, but most of the people outside of it just don't know. But anyways, and New York at the time, you know, Pennsylvania, the fracking boom was just kind of getting lit, no pun intended, right here in the state. But in New York, they had a moratorium on fracking, right? And that goes to all the benefit to the kind of the activists that kind of really got out in front of it, pushed for a moratorium. And they were in the middle of a political process. Right. So the governor and the state at that point had decided, say, well, you know, we're going to put in a moratorium and we're going to study this stuff before we make any decisions. And at the same time, we had Gasland had come out. We'd see kind of reporting like Dimmick, PA was kind of all over the news of the water that you could light on fire and stuff. And that's all along Route 29 coming through Pennsylvania. And so I decided, you know what, I'm coming back, you know, just wanted the space just to kind of reflect on my grandmother and, you know, the family that we talked about. And so, you know what, why don't I just go down Route 29? just to kind of see, you know, firsthand this, you know, these places that I've been reading about and talking about. And so I went down Route 29, and as you're going down in 29 in New York, there's like signs all over the place. It's like, you know, ban fracking now, or kind of like time for a moratorium, keep the moratorium, study first before we move forward. And then people on the other side of it, right? Responsible drilling in New York, right? Save farms. You know, there's all the people all over the political spectrum. But it was very clear there was an active public political process of decision making that was happening, right? And people in those communities impacted were you know, impact, you know, they were involved. Literally, when I cross over the border into Pennsylvania, I remember it like it was night and day, because I'd never been to this place before, and you kind of come across this weird little bridge, you know, into Pennsylvania, and there's a little clearing. You kind of, it opens up a little bit, and there's kind of like the mountain, you're immediately in the mountains, and there, right there, was a fracking well, right? And it was like on fire. Not the entire plane. They were flaming up, right? Like nice big torch at the top of your well, right? To signal that, yes, here we are. And that entire trip down, I saw that, you know, there's a stream that runs alongside 29. And I'm looking off to the side. You try not to get into an accident because it's pretty windy. But there's like people laying the pipeline right along the river, right? Right next to the stream with the water in it, right? That we drink. And then coming down even kind of closer into Tunkhannock, right? Past Dimmick and stuff. The truck traffic was unbelievable. The water trucks coming in were, and you could see the road had already started deteriorating in that. And this is like, you know, again, like early on in the boom. And so it just was striking to me about the difference a political process can make and how we approach these questions of regulation. And a point that, you know, you make, Christina, in the reporting, or I wouldn't say just a point that you make, but rather the point that is coming out in the reporting is how the lack of regulation, particularly in Pennsylvania, and again, I'll use these words, right? Really sold out these families. That was part of if there had been more responsible regulation and a commitment up front about looking at the health impacts in this, a lot of this stuff could have been avoided. But no. So tell us a little bit about what you see and what you saw as kind of the policy discussion in the state and the lack of regulation in Pennsylvania over fracking.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that you bring up New York, because one of the things I learned through this reporting was that New York put that moratorium on fracking that eventually turned into a ban in 2014 on the basis of 400 studies that showed a harm or the potential for harm caused by living near fracking. The studies they looked at were put together into a compendium by two groups, concerned health professionals of New York and Physicians for Social Responsibility. So they banned fracking on the basis of 400 studies. And those groups continued putting out this compendium every year ever since then. And in the most recent, the seventh edition that came out in December of 2020, they had more than 2,000 studies that showed either harm, demonstrated harm or potential harm from fracking. So we have a lot of science on this at this point. So I think that in the reporting, I laid out some of the specific problems that are happening in Pennsylvania and why they're happening here. But I think it's important to note that this kind of lack of regulatory framework isn't just in Pennsylvania. Right. So in fracking towns across the state and certainly across the country, people have really struggled to get answers about what's happening on their land and in their communities. And, you know, as I demonstrated, certainly in their bodies. And so on the federal level, fracking wells are mostly unregulated compared to other polluting industries. So they're technically subject to the Clean Air Act, but there are no air monitoring requirements for fracking wells. So monitoring and enforcement are largely left to the states. And that's very different than, say, like that the Koch plants that I mentioned, yep, where there are federal requirements about air monitoring and reporting of emissions. And that kind of structure just doesn't exist for fracking wells at the federal level. And so a lot of this regulation is and monitoring and enforcement are left to the states. And then states are often just under-budgeted, understaffed, and under-resourced when it comes to this kind of stuff. And then the boom happened very quickly. So yeah. A lot of times states didn't have the ability to hire all of the scientists and air quality experts and just actual staff to physically go out and do inspections to be able to keep up with the volume of these fracking wells in a meaningful way. And so in the reporting, I found examples of this in a bunch of different states. So in Ohio, a 3-year investigation published in 2020 by the environmental advocacy group Earthworks showed that the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency and the Ohio Department of Natural Resources failed to act on 39% of public complaints filed against regarding air pollution from the oil and gas industry, meaning like they just didn't respond. The complaints were made and they just didn't have anyone to go out and take a look. There was a 2018 incident in Ohio that really exemplified the consequences of this. So there was an explosion at an Exxon fracking well in Belmont County, which is actually pretty close to Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And the site leaked methane at a rate of about 132 US tons an hour for 20 days. And that ultimately resulted in that site emitting more methane than the entire oil and gas industries of France, Norway, or the Netherlands do an entire year.
Let that sit with you for
20 days. In the course of 20 days.
20 days.
Yeah.
And methane, of course, as you mentioned this too, is methane is a worse greenhouse gas. Right, at least over the short term, right?
That's right.
You know,
yeah.
It's kind of condensed at the kind of the front end of its lifetime, but it's like but it's a worse greenhouse gas. Just let that sit with you. 20 days. Yeah.
So carbon dioxide is more powerful over like a 100-year period, but methane is 84 times more climate warming than carbon dioxide over a 20-year period. And when we talk about climate change, you know, as we all know, we're looking at a 20-year period that's important exactly. to all of us,
yep.
especially who, you know, people who are living today.
Yeah, want to live, right? Exactly. Want to live in a non-dystopian future. Yes, that was important.
And similar stories have cropped up in Colorado. So researchers uncovered a pattern of fracking-related crimes going unreported or unacknowledged in North Dakota. Journalists found that accidents and spills were underreported and that regulators rarely used the enforcement tools that they had at their disposal to address them or specifically to impose any kind of sanctions. And in Texas, you know, investigative reports have revealed that the industry is being largely left to self-regulate. So a lot of times, you know, I certainly talked to people in the course of this reporting who thought there was like some nefarious collusion between state government organizations and the fracking industry. And there are certainly like isolated incidents of that happening. So there was the big grand jury report that came out about
yeah.
fracking in Pennsylvania from Attorney General Josh Shapiro's office last summer, or was it the summer before, found a bunch of examples of, they called it a revolving door, where so someone worked at the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection would grant favors to a fracking company. So they found one example where a Department of Environmental Protection employee signed off on the paperwork that a fracking company needed to plug some wells without making them take the legal steps required to make sure that it was safe and not leaking and not going to harm the community. Like multiple times for the same company, multiple wells, they did this. They just didn't make them do the stuff they were legally required to yeah. do. And then like the next month they were hired by that fracking company for, you know, double or triple the salary they were making as a state regulator, probably. And they found numerous examples of that. So there are some isolated incidents where that kind of thing is happening. But I think my impression is that overall, it's a lot of well-intentioned people who work, you know, you don't go into being a state regulator for the money. It's not a super
totally.
Glamorous or lucrative job. So for the most part,
well, you get your own TV show, right? No, there's really, where are the right. perks? There's not many.
Right. It's a tough job that doesn't pay super well. And people go into this kind of work because they want to help and they care about people. So my impression is actually that it's more a matter of just a lack of a meaningful regulatory and enforcement framework. And then, as I said, a lack of resources, just an inability to respond to every complaint or concern in a way that's meaningful. Especially, you know, we talked earlier about the kind of lack of health departments right. in the state of Pennsylvania. And that's something that came up again and again. People, you know, one of the people, one of the families we tested were having, that we haven't discussed, Brian Latkinich mm-hmm. and his son Ryan, were having all these problems with their water. And the DEP tested their water and told them it was undrinkable, but determined that the fracking company wasn't to blame. And a big, like, multi-year investigation by this news outlet, Public Herald, out here in Western Pennsylvania, found that they looked at something, you know, it was, hold on, I did put it in my notes, maybe 4,000 complaints.
4,100, yep, 4,100
complaints. 4,100 oil and gas-related drinking water complaints filed by Pennsylvania residents over a 13-year period. The Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection ruled that it was not related to oil and gas activity 93% of the time. So Brian was one of those families. But then when he contacted the Department of Health, his son, Ryan, who we included in our testing, came out of the bathtub or the shower with sores all over his body, like multiple times, like painful, bleeding sores. And when he reached out to the Department of Health, their suggestion was go to the nearest YMCA to shower.
That
he's already buying bottled water to drink at a, you know, he said he spends about $70 a month on bottled water for the two of them. And then, but they still have to bathe and shower at home. And they're a family who can't afford to move and they have a private well, so no one's coming to clean their well water. Yeah, and the nearest YMCA is about a 30-minute drive away from him. So he said, what are we supposed to do? Like, we can't, we're going to spend an hour in the car every day just to shower.
Well, and let's take the most generous reading that we can of that advice, right? Mm-hmm. Of somebody who said, like, look, I don't know what to tell you. I don't know what solutions to do. Maybe go to a YMCA. Let's just put the nicest face on that person who's telling him this, right?
Yeah.
What that points to in the best possible scenario is an utter breakdown of a political or say democratic process for which they're dealing with the level of the size and scope of this issue. Cause like, let's be clear. Like, one, you're talking about the most powerful industry on the planet, right? With infinite resources being able to kind of come in and make its case, right? Mm-hmm. Number one. Number two, you're talking about areas, right, that are often kind of like significantly impacted, like economically impacted mm-hmm. by things that before the fossil fuel industry, right? Where you have breakdowns in kind of former economies and you have like deep holes in the economy where people are looking for jobs, that you have an economic crisis, mm-hmm. right? And then you're talking about like a lack of a regulatory framework, right, on top of that. And so, and then if you add into it, right, a political context, right, which is pro fossil fuel, right, mm-hmm. you've got like the perfect storm there, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have the political will to address the scope of the problems. And so what's left is like, what's left is some, like, you know, some poor person at a county office saying like, I don't know, go to the YMCA.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, because in the worst case scenario, you look at that person who tells them to go to the YMCA and you think that they're the biggest piece of blank that you could possibly think. But even if you're generous in that, it's so much bigger than just that interpersonal thing. But, you know, you say right in this thing where Brian is his name. Is that right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Brian. He's, you know, this is the kind of thing that has led him to feel like in despair when it comes to the response from, say, local and kind of state government officials.
Yeah, that's right. He just felt like he had reached out again and again and again to the Department of Environmental Protection and the Department of Health and also his doctor and his toxicologists, and he just couldn't get answers. You know, I think it was, of course, worrisome to get the results from our testing, but he also expressed that it was, he felt like it was the first time he was getting information that he had been looking for years and years and years. It was the first time that somebody said, like, yeah, we did this testing and here's what we found in your body. You know, and otherwise he just felt like he got the runaround from the fracking company. Yeah. He got the runaround from the state health department. He got the runaround from the DEP. And I think you're right. You know, I did ask the Department of Health, you know, is this a typical response to if someone has concerns about the quality of their water? Do you typically tell them to go shower at a YMCA?
Oh, jump in the lake, literally. I mean, like, this, it's like,
yeah, so like, is this standard procedure? And they kind of said, like, you know, we don't have the jurisdiction to, as a health department, if it was municipal water, there were obviously levers they could pull to say, like, the municipal water provider has to clean this up. But when it's a private well, you know, as we've all seen, people in Flint, Michigan still don't have clean drinking water. Right. How many years in? So access to clean drinking water is a real problem in the United States. And then when it comes to these kind of like one-off cases where someone has a private well that's been poisoned, there just isn't capacity in the current regulatory systems we have in Pennsylvania for sure. To help these folks. So.
Well, and even the solution, right? I mean, he's told one, well, you know, he considered hooking up to municipal water, right? But I mean, yeah. He's going to bear the cost.
Right.
Right. I mean,
and he's also had concerns about the safety of the municipal water
which is a fair concern.
Right. You know, he mentioned there have been numerous cases. That water in particular is in a region where like the local landfill found out after the fact that they were taking fracking wastewater and that like not being properly informed and didn't know how to properly clean it. And so, right. That was another situation where he just felt like we're already only drinking bottled water. We try to shower fast. Like what else can we do here? Yeah. And he really felt, you know, his story is part three in the 4-part series. And I really thought he just really felt like he was failed by regulators and the governmental agencies that are supposed to protect Pennsylvania residents.
So you do talk to some of the regulators and some of the politicians who are kind of say more, let's see, say, I don't want to say pro fossil fuels because I want to be careful about that, because you mentioned, I'm spacing on his name right now. He's a Democratic representative and you're talking about particularly around the cracker plant.
I think that's Robert Matsey.
Yeah.
Robert Matsey.
Right. And so in his case, right. So it's not like he's just like fossil fuels rule, everything like this. Like you see him trying to walk this line of say jobs for the community, but we're going to support this. So all this back, how what kind of responses were you getting from these folks who are actually in positions of decision or regulation about how could they let this happen? That'd be my question. Like, how the hell do you let something like this get to this point?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it was a really kind of mixed response. And unfortunately, it was pretty clearly along party lines with some nuances like the ones that you mentioned. But, Representative Matsey said he was really focused on jobs for his constituents, which is understandable, especially out where he is. They've been really kind of economically devastated by the loss of the steel industry and have never fully recovered. And then simultaneously, he said, like, I'm not sure how to reconcile that with, you know, knowing what I know about how people are exposed to living in fracking wells. And then he said, like, we absolutely don't regulate those well enough as a state, and we need to do better. And, you know, he essentially said, like, some Democrats have been trying, and with a Republican-controlled legislature, it's just not going to happen. It's just not going through. So as part of my follow-up to this, I'm in the process now of starting to reach out to lawmakers in the state of Pennsylvania who are in these kind of decision-making positions to share with them the full report, because I was doing these interviews before mm-hmm. the stories came out, obviously, since they're included in the stories. So to share with them the full report and then also some of the high-level, like a one-page of, you know, here's the most important stuff we found, because I recognize that policymakers are extremely busy and may not have time to read the full series. And then ask them that question, essentially, and publicly document their responses. So I'll be letting them know, you know, I'm going to post your response online along with your contact information so that if your constituents are interested in following up, they have access to do so. Here's what we found. you know, and then like a list of five questions about how do you intend to address this and make sure that Pennsylvanians are protected.
I am going to wait with bated breath for that to come out. Yeah. I will be refreshing my pages.
So that'll be coming. That's a couple weeks away. We want to give people adequate time to respond if we're going to publicly put out their responses. I think that'll be an important component of following up on the series is kind of saying like, you know, now that we know this is happening, what's next?
So the one other thing that I want to kind of point out, this one thing I thought was extraordinarily important. You look at Colorado, right, as a state that made a turn, right, that, you know, followed a very similar path that we see in a lot of these kind of boom bust economies, right, especially around, say, fracking and natural gas. But Colorado kind of got to a point where, say, well, wait a minute, we're going to change our direction in terms of how we deal with regulation here. Can you talk through that a little bit? Because the point that's really important point, because you mentioned this at the beginning of this segment, where the science is out there, right? We have examples that already exist. We don't need to, like, you know, reinvent the wheel here. We've got clear models, and the folks in Colorado seem willing to share it with anybody who wanted to see it, right?
Yeah. So Colorado is a really interesting case. They just recently, they had like hundreds of hours of public hearings on the safety of fracking. And after years of kind of doing stuff that was similar to what Pennsylvania had been doing, like they did a couple literature reviews where they tried to look at all the science that was on there on fracking, but they had these really stringent requirements for what kind of study could be included that, you know, environmental advocates and health advocates have criticized as saying, essentially, some of them were requirements that this would be like a controlled study, which you can't do. You can't intentionally expose people to fracking chemicals. It's unethical. Yeah, so <right. laughs> we're stuck with going out to these communities and seeing what's happening. So people were kind of critical of the, you know, the requirements they had for including a study, because then they would look, you know, they'd look at those 2,000 studies and say, well, only 30 of those met our stringent requirements. And of those 30, we can't say one way or the other if fracking is bad, is causing these harms to people. So they were pretty heavily criticized for some of that. And so they did their own air monitoring study, a really extensive air monitoring study over a long period of time, where they did that kind of like constant air monitoring I described. And they found that they only looked up to 2,000 feet away from a well, but they found that at all the distances they looked at, from right up against a well to up to 2,000 feet away, there were levels of air emissions coming off of fracking wells that were high enough to harm human health. And so they pretty quick, and this was like the state health department and oil and gas. Sorry that their names are escaping me, but these were state agencies that did this research. Right. And after that, they had these, you know, like 180 hours of public hearings on this. They brought in a bunch of the researchers I talked to about my data actually said they had just been in Colorado testifying about this. So they contacted like scientific leaders, and then they had all these other stakeholders come in. They had landowners, and of course they had representatives from industry, and they had all these public hearings. And after the public hearings, they pretty drastically changed the way they're regulating the industry. So among their new rules is that they changed to a 2,000 foot setback for new unconventional oil and gas wells. It had previously been, I think 500 feet, which is what it is in Pennsylvania and a bunch of other states. And that's the distance that a new well has to be from a school or home or a residence. They put into place a requirement that fracking companies capture and eliminate 95% of harmful pollutants.
That's astounding.
During fracking. It's pretty up there. And I should mention, a lot of these are relatively new, so they're still working on implementation. So there's some stuff that remains to be seen, how well and effectively they're able to implement these, but they're ambitious in the rulemaking. They have a requirement that emissions are monitored from the start of construction of a new well through the 6 months of production, the first 6 months of production. They have a ban on routine flaring or venting, which is what we talked about, those big flames. They tend to be particularly nasty. And that happens when there's extra gas that they're unable to sell, or it wouldn't be cost effective to transport and sell, so they just burn it off. A new system aimed at tracking the industry's cumulative impacts that they plan to have look at things like emissions from truck traffic and kind of all the secondary sources of pollution in addition to just what's coming out of the well pads, new protections for wildlife and waterways, increased transparency and public input in the permitting process, and they're incorporating environmental justice considerations. So looking at the poverty rate and racial makeup of communities that are going to be impacted by these emissions during the permitting process. So they really are, they also fundamentally changed the mission of the organization tasked with overseeing the industry and granting permits from, I think the language used to be like fostering oil and gas development, and now it's to like protecting communities and the environment, which is pretty radical. So they've really made a lot of changes. And they did say, you know, I talked to some of the people who were instrumental in enacting those changes and doing some of that research that I mentioned. And they were like, we're an open book. You know, Pennsylvania doesn't need to reinvent the wheel on this. We put everything online, like it's all public, and we'd be happy to talk to anybody from Pennsylvania who wants to talk. You know, and I asked Pennsylvania regulators, would you look to what Colorado did and take their example? And they had a very pat response. They said, like, we're always looking for better ways to protect the residents of the Commonwealth, and we're happy to hear from other states. But, you know, no like concrete promises about any of that. But yeah, it was really, it's been really impressive to see like what a radical shift Colorado made in like a 2-year period when it comes to regulating this industry. So I think it really demonstrates that it's possible, that this kind of thing is possible. And they really took a science-driven approach. They did their own science. You know, they brought in leading experts in air pollution and in some of these chemical exposures had a lot of public input. So they really did this in a clear, transparent way, which I thought was impressive.
Well, that's what, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. One of the things that I came away with, it was just, like, it shows you that it's possible. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to take a 10, 15, 20 year process, right? Mm-hmm. Is that there's ways that this can actually turn on a dime. And I think that becomes all the more critical as, I mean, obviously the health impacts like of like families in Pennsylvania kind of mount, right? Mm-hmm. As we saw from the report that I mentioned before from the Ohio River Valley Institute, we're talking mm-hmm. about the economic impact, the big boom and the help for the economies has just not panned out. That was a promise mm-hmm. that was not kept, right? And we've got the crisis of climate change, right? Which is mm-hmm. bearing down on everyone. And to see what they did in Colorado to say, okay, you know, I can remember too as well. I was flying out there for a conference, not in Colorado, but over Colorado. And the plane had happened to go over the area that they were doing a lot of the natural gas stuff. So you just saw fields mm-hmm. of these natural gas pipelines. So we're not talking about like a small corner of the state with a few wells. We're talking about a significant investment in that kind of infrastructure. And to see them flip like that, mm-hmm. You know, and again, 2 years, okay, maybe flipping in political terms, that's a flip, right? That's like literally flipping the coin the other side.
Absolutely.
And then to say like, look, it's possible in Colorado, right? And now that also becomes a tool for organizers, right? I mean, because like you said, if you talk to politicians now, a lot of them are going to be like, well, we're always, you know, looking out for the health of safety, blah, 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 right? But now that becomes a tool for people on the ground who are doing the organizing to basically say, no, we want this, right? Mm-hmm. No, we don't need 1,000 other hearings, right? We're going to take what New York State did, you know, those 4,000 other studies that are up there that organization has. We're going to look at the implementation process that they have in Colorado, and we want this and we want it now. So it becomes so important, I think, for the, you know, the organizers who are attempting to kind of protect, like, you know, the citizens of the Commonwealth, right, mm-hmm. As well as our collective future, to make sure that, you know, we use these tools to kind of push them forward. Because, you know, politicians, one thing, they're going to pay attention to those folks that are bringing them things. Yes, it's true. You say, hey, you want to look out for the health? Yes, of course we want to work. Everybody, who doesn't mm-hmm. want to, who disagrees with health, right? But say, no, we want these specific things and we want them now. And we have a name, we're going to take names, and we want a timeline. We want it by this mm-hmm. date. And if it's not by this date, then this thing is going to happen. And I think that's the way we move forward. So this is why I was thrilled to hear that this is the next stage. This is going to be one of my questions for you anyways. So, okay, now we're actually going to bring these to legislators now to see where, you know, to see where we can kind of, you know, push the discourse in some sense.
Yeah. And I think, so one of the other things I hope will come out of this are, I mentioned that there was this kind of gap in the data in, you know, there's all these studies, epidemiological studies that show that people who live closer to fracking are more likely to have migraines and nosebleeds or preterm births, you know, this long list of health effects. But then there wasn't much data on whether these chemicals are getting into people's bodies. But I also, and I wanted to demonstrate that, like, we could start filling in that gap if we do more of this on a larger scale. But I also really wanted to help fill that gap for these particular families. And so one thing that's been really inspiring to see is the way that they are using these test results to advocate for themselves and the health of their families and their communities. So Lois Bauer-Bjornsson, that mom in the first story mm-hmm. we talked about, she is just a total powerhouse, and she has been CCing me on emails to every legislator she can think of, saying, like, look at this report. This is my family. This is real. This is happening to us. What are you going to do about it? And, you know, I heard from, even though I think, like I mentioned, it was difficult to get this kind of unsettling health information, especially during a global pandemic. Yeah. I am hearing from these families that they now feel like they have a tool to say, like, you know, people yeah. can, you know, that they can kind of answer back to people who are saying, like, well, maybe you're just sensitive, or maybe you're making it up, or like, why are you so worried about this when the industry says it's fine and politicians
just
are saying,
like,
it's fine.
Here, this.
Yeah, right. right. But they now have this science to be able to say, like, actually we checked and this is what we found. And so how do we move this conversation forward? And so, you know, that has been really inspiring. And I do hope that, you know, others are able to kind of take this and use it as a tool to talk to their doctors and talk to their policymakers and be better equipped to advocate for their health and work on keeping their families and their communities safe.
That is so awesome to hear. That is so awesome to hear. That's, I mean, this is like the best outcome you could possibly want from a significant piece of journalism like this. I mean, it's just pretty incredible. So everybody, we're going to take one more quick break. We're going to come back and kind of wrap things up and talk a little bit about, say the bigger picture and some, you know, some kind of directions to go from here. So this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. I want to remind you, you can help support the show by going to patreon.com/RC Press. We'll be back right after this quick break. More.
I was a steward of my land, wanting this to be a generational farm for my children, and they've crushed my dream. You know, my constitution under Article 21, Section 1 guarantees clean air and water, pure water and air. I want it. I'm demanding it. They're violating my rights. That's how I look at it. Yeah, you're going to always have a little bit of pollution, but to the point that your son's so toxic that, no, I got to live with that. When does the cancer come? When does the heart disease come? When does the real problem start? You know, and to have my son be 91 times higher than the 95, then, wow. I'm sorry, I'm a little stuttering on that one. It's hard to digest.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Yes, we are back to kind of close things out today. I'm here, of course, once again with Christina Marusik. And this has been just an amazing conversation. And before I talk about this last thing and close things out, I just want to give a plug to a plugin. Okay. And this is going to be the geekiest thing you're going to hear in this show today. Okay. But when I went to their website, Environmental Health News, and I was kind of reading Christina's report, I went to print it because I'm like old school Gen X dude who's like learned to read and like hard copy. So I went in and printed it out, and they have got this plugin on the site that's called printfriendly.com. And if you print using that, right, you go printfriendly.com, you press it. You don't even need to install the plugin at first, but you can just do it right from their website. It basically prints things out, like with all the images and ads and everything like that gone. it's like freaking magic. So I just wanted to like shout out to every frustrated like online printer who likes to read text and paper out there. One, it cuts down on your paper usage, right? And it makes it's super easy. So I just want to put that out there. I'm not getting paid by anybody to say that. I'm just letting people know that I really, really appreciate little things like that. So anyways, well, to close us out today, I mean, one of the things that, you know, I walked away reading the series from, right, given that we've got underperforming kind of economic kind of development, at least when it comes to the actual communities that were being impacted by this. I mean, we know that, you know, the fossil fuel companies have made like hand over fist billions of dollars off this industry, right? But in terms of the jobs and the long-term economic impact of communities, that has not panned out at all. Number two, we have kind of environmental impacts, right? Just in terms of, say, the infrastructure of the areas. And now with this kind of reporting here, we have significant and severe, potentially long-term health impacts from the fracking industry. So on the one hand, we've got an avenue like, you know, in some ways, I'll just say best case scenario right now, we say take on the model of what we have in Colorado, right? So kind of really kind of do some significant, you know, significant regulation and significant change of kind of direction in terms of what we're dealing with. And I'm all in for that 100%. But what it does raise is it raises the question of like, if we look at kind of the pressing crisis of climate change right now, is it worth it, right? I mean, is this continued investment in the fossil fuel infrastructure in this state and across this country even worth it, given the kind of severity of the crisis that we are facing right now when it comes to the climate? So I know that's a kind of like, you know, the, you know, 20,000 foot kind of place to kind of leave us with today. But I'm just kind of curious how you might kind of say come at that. I mean, you mentioned already in here that, you know, that the methane that was coming out, that we saw the kind of what that contributed here. But we know that, you know, for a long time, and this is Democrats and Republicans alike, right? I mean, Obama was a big champion of this, saying that no, natural gas is our bridge fuel, right? It's got me questioning that. Can that even really be the case given the severity of the climate crisis that is upon us? I mean, curious your thoughts.
Yeah, it's a big question. Yeah. So I think what's, you mentioned some of those financial questions, which I think are certainly part of this. I talked to some analysts who pointed out that investors have really been burned by the fossil fuel industry too. Mm-hmm. They have this huge debt overhang and they're operating at a loss. And then, you know, we have that report that you spoke with Sean O'Leary about showing that local economies aren't benefiting that much. So the cost benefit analysis obviously needs some updating, I think.
Yeah.
But in terms of, you know, we were kind of sold as a nation on the idea of fracking and natural gas as a bridge fuel, like you mentioned, to get us, that was sort of how Obama pitched it, to get us from traditional fossil fuels to renewables. But some recent research has shown that natural gas extraction might actually be causing a lot more climate warming than we originally thought. So the Environmental Defense Fund did a study from 2012 to 2018 and found that methane emissions from natural gas extraction are a lot higher than government estimates take into account. So they estimated that, what did they say? At least 13 million metric tons of methane that are specifically coming from leaks. So these are like undocumented, unmonitored, and largely unreported emissions. And they did this through satellite imaging. And so that number is about 60% higher than EPA's estimate based on reported emissions. And they say the wasted gas is enough to fuel 10 million homes for a year and it would be worth an estimated $2 billion. So I talked to one researcher about this who said, you know, we essentially went out of the frying pan and into the fire when it comes to natural gas because, you know, as we discussed, methane is much more climate warming than carbon dioxide over a shorter time period, which is what we have to work with. So, yeah, I think that it's, you know, as you mentioned, it's a big and complex question, and it's easier said than done to just say we should stop doing this. because there are lots of dependencies and political considerations. Absolutely. And et cetera. So I don't want to oversimplify what's a complicated issue. But I certainly think that the kind of big picture cost benefit analysis needs to be revisited at this point.
Well, you know, and I think, you know, for whatever it's worth, I mean, I frequently will say on kind of our podcast is like, okay, look, you know, I'm going to give like free political consultant work, you know, advice right here, right? Yeah, whatever. But, you know, and like you said, this is easier said than done. But it also gets to some, I think, given your reporting and kind of given the way that the, you know, these families have been impacted and the communities have been impacted, I also think that we need to be clear-eyed about what that kind of transition needs to look like. And this is, you know, one of the things that I really appreciated when you had folks come out with the Green New Deal is like one of the things that they really honed in on is the fact that these communities need to be on the front lines for the redevelopment towards a kind of a renewable future. So that if we're going to be building windmills, if we're going to be building solar panels, if we're going to be coming up with the technologies that are, you know, are going to power our future, these communities need to be like first in line for that kind of investment, because they've literally, I mean, as you say in your reporting, I mean, as you've shown in your reporting, they've literally are paying with their bodies. And this is not new. I mean, I have this conversation very frequently is like, you know, when people will say, well, you know, we have a long history of that. Yeah. But we also have a, you know, coal industry. Yes. We powered it, but it was also gave us black lung.
Yeah.
Right. It also made kids like dying early, like earlier in their lives, because they're sitting there as the breaker boys kind of breaking up in the coal. Right. They never make it to 20 years old. Right. Mm-hmm. We're also talking about generations of people who have sacrificed with their bodies and their lives. And so in this kind of transition, it makes 100% sense to target these areas for that kind of development. And what I hope is that if I had a hope beyond hope, at least if we're able to look at the science and really look at our options here, we have a short-term solution like we see in Colorado, but the long-term one is going to mean we're going to have to kind of pay back, right? Mm-hmm. The generations of cost that we've inflicted upon these people. So, I mean, I mean, I know that's, again, easier said than done, but all the more reason that this kind of work is so critical.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let me ask you this to kind of close the way out. You mentioned, you know, I mentioned at the top of the show that, you know, first of all, I'm so thrilled, like you said in the last segment, that this report is going places, right? Both the families are using this report. And actually, you have got some follow-up reporting coming here, working with a state legislator saying, hey, what are these responses? But you also got a book, right? A little bit kind of a longer scope here. So tell us a little bit about the book that you're working on. I was thrilled to hear this when you told me at the start of the show. I'm like, this is fantastic. I got more of your stuff to read. It's great.
Thank you. So the working title is The New War on Cancer, and that might change through the editing process. So keep an eye out in case the title changes. But so essentially, you were really hitting on this when you talked about how these families are kind of doing everything they can to minimize their exposures on an individual level. And so the book is focused on the ways that cancer prevention has historically in the United States really focused on individual behaviors and the ways that individuals can modify their own behaviors, you know, not smoking, exercising, eating healthy food. But now there's this new push to address environmental exposures to cancer-causing chemicals, which all of us are facing. So I documented some of these specific families that might be facing higher than average exposures because they live near fracking. But we know that over the last 70 years, we have all been introduced to hundreds and hundreds of new chemicals, as Americans specifically, because of the way chemicals are regulated or not so regulated in this country. And lots of them have been found and are still being found to increase cancer risk. So the book is not focused so much on all of the things that we're exposed to that could cause cancer in us, although certainly some of that's in there for context, but it's really going to be a hopeful book that looks at the people who are pushing for solutions to this. So there's this kind of nationwide movement that includes, I think it's particularly interesting because it's not just activists, although activists certainly play an important role, but it's also cancer researchers and scientists and physicians and people who work in public health. And there's like nurse associations and organizations that are involved in this work who are really saying, you know, telling people how they can act on an individual level to reduce their exposures is not enough. We need to implement systemic change that will protect everyone from cancer-causing chemicals in their everyday lives. You shouldn't have to have a science PhD
exactly.
and to go to the grocery store and buy or the drugstore and buy products that are safe for your family and for your kids. We need to make it so that and also be able to afford the much more expensive products that come without carcinogens. And so it's really, I'm thinking of the book as really a kind of like portrait of this movement. And so I'm talking about the science and the policy pushes that are happening through the lens of kind of profiles of the people who are doing this work. So I'm talking about, you know, a lot of the people, the researchers I'm talking to are scientists who are doing work related to this, but they have kids of their own. And so they're talking about how this comes up in their own lives and the kind of journey that led them to want to do this work and push for this kind of change. So yeah, I hope people will keep an eye out for it. I'm still kind of in early stages of writing it, but I'm really excited for this book to be in the world.
Well, fantastic. Well, I'll tell you, I'm going to be on the pre-order list of that book as soon as that becomes possible. And I'm thrilled. And, you know, so everybody, you know, first of all, I want to thank you for being so generous with your time here today. I mean, this is really extraordinary work that you've done here. And I could think that, you know, this is only going to help, I hope, right, amplify the work that you've already done. And really, you know, for these words to become tools in the struggle, right, and the fight for a healthier future. I mean, that is really the goal. And, you know, if you're not already kind of following Christina on her work over at Environmental Health News, do yourself a favor and do that. There'll be links in the show notes here, but absolutely 100% put it on the front burner. Make sure that you read this series. It's called Fractured, The Body Burden of Living Near Fracking. It's a 4-part series. It's absolutely extraordinary. It's a phenomenal read, but just give yourself some places to pause because parts of it are pretty devastating, especially when you hear what's happening to some of these kids. That's what got me. And families and communities. So thank you so much for your time today. Head on over to Environmental Health News too as well. Check out their reporting. So thank you so much for your time. And great work. And I hope to be kind of checking back in you in the near future because I'd love to have you back.
Yeah, thank you so much, Kevin. This has been a really great conversation. I appreciate it.
Fantastic. Well, thank you everybody for kind of tuning in here today. Please do check out that book. I'm getting a little out of myself. Check out that investigative series. Go over to Environmental Health News. Look for Fractured, The Body Burden of Living Near Fracking. Thanks again to Christina Marusik. Did I get it right the last time? Yes, Marusik for her time today. And for you, everybody out there, we want to support this kind of work, making sure that we kind of amplify the voices that are kind of helping us with our struggle. Make sure that you can become a patron by going to patreon.com/rcpress. Become a patron for little as $5 a month. Thank you so much. And hey, everybody, we'll be back on Friday with our regular weekly news roundup with Sean Kitchen. And then next Monday, it's either going to be open phones. We're talking about what the hell they're doing with public higher education in this state, right? Or we might have the new progressive reporter of Bucks County. See ya!